accession number 19049, Reel 7.
Malcolm Connolly, Reel 7.
Yeah, they would have OP officers out in inventory, patrols out, hoping that because we were prominent, that they would open up and try and take us out. We used to call it stooging. On this particular occasion, my troop, which was 6th Troop at the time, had been ordered for this particular job. The 105 was holding up the advance down the Titham Road, because as I've explained, it was a very, very, just a ledge stuck on the side of a mountain. And so it was easy to hold up the advance of anything that might want to advance along it. Anyway, on this particular occasion, on a position that we were able to leave the road, for there wasn't many times that we were in a situation to leave the road and deploy. But on this particular occasion, we were in a position where we could leave the road and climb, I think, somewhere about 5,000 feet to the top of this mountain. It's part of the Chin Hills, which is a range of mountains, really. Anyway, we went out, and the first tank, which was the troop corporal's tank, left the road, only to be mined just a matter of a few yards after leaving the road. I was driving the troop officer, which was a David Mean Austin, and we took the advance. We climbed past the tank that was destroyed. Nobody hurt, but the tank, its tracks were severely damaged. And we started to climb up this mountain, hoping to get on top where we'd been ordered to sit, hoping this gun, which was on an alternative hill in advance of us, might open up. Anyway, we climbed up, got up there, and the troop sergeant who came up behind us, he had difficulty climbing because it was quite a steep mountain covered in jungle. And anyway, I got up there, and my troop sergeant was quite some way behind. And as soon as we got on top, onto the skyline, this Jap gun opened up, and they plastered us all the way round. And we was only saved, really, by the young troop officer, David Mean Austin, by his skill and his bravery, really. And we couldn't go back, so we had to continue climbing. And this Jap gun really had a pot shot at us. The troop sergeant realised what was going on, and he scarpered, which left us in this very awkward situation. Anyway, we couldn't stay there. Nobody had been hurt up to that time. The troop officer's face was bleeding because he'd had his head out the top. And he hadn't hit us. We kept going forward and reversing and things like that. And eventually, it was decided we would reverse back out. We reversed the same way as we came out. It was the only way out. And the Jap let us go. The Nips let us go. Didn't utter a sound. Let us go. And we patrolled back down the hill in reverse gear. And we harboured in a nuller with the troop sergeant. The troop sergeant was one side and troop officer was the other. It was just the two of us. The third one was down the bottom. Anyway, it was decided my troop officer and I, we crawled up onto the ridge just with field glasses to see if we could spot this gun. And they should really have found it anyway. Because it had opened up, it put quite a few shells around us, though it hadn't hit us. Anyway, what happened was that we went up, and David Mean Austin reported back to the squadron what was left of the squadron down the bottom. And we got the order to leave, to reverse back down the mountain, and that was that. Well, it was only a matter of minutes when the troop sergeant reported that he'd thrown a track. So my troop officer got out to see if he could help, and he was standing a matter of 6-8 feet in front of the troop sergeant's tank when a shell came over and killed him. his belly open. Anyway, a lump of the shrapnel went straight through the visor and took the driver's head off. Trooper Kerr. The troop sergeant had been hit with the same lump of shrapnel. It had killed the driver, taken the arm muscle off a 3.7 gunner, I think he was. Whitcomb, his name was anyway. Come from the West Riding. He was a policeman in peacetime. West Riding policeman. Anyway, they wouldn't open up. And we had a hell of a job to persuade them to open. Eventually, they opened up. And there was no command, because I was only a trooper. And the troop sergeant had been knocked out. He was flat out by a lump of shrapnel. And the troop officer was dead. The driver in there was dead. The young operator was out of his head, because he sat next to the driver and got all his blood and brains over him, and he was in a fit state. And there was a chap there, quite an elderly man, because the system was, they used to put older men with younger men, because they say older men don't panic. That's not quite true, but anyway that was the system. And this bloke, Johnny Innes, he shut down, wouldn't open up, and eventually, through the medium of the wireless, we persuaded him to open up. So I got in touch, I ordered my operator to get in touch with the squadron and ask, what do we do? And it came back, Major Ian Morgan came back and said that we were to leave the tanks and go, that a Jap counterattack was expected and we were to go. Well, anyway, what happened was that all fit members of my crew was to help the unfit members of the other crew, and they scarpered. And I decided I wouldn't go. I stayed. That's what I got.
What was the date of that?
Pardon?
The date of it.
Date? Oh, it's on there, isn't it?
We'll look at it later. What month was it, anyway?
I think it was November. Sorry about that. But
November 44.
November 44. Well, that's right, yeah. Mm. Yeah. And it continued the story. Anyway, I stayed there. And nobody knew I was there. All the rest went, and I stayed. And I had a job. This one. What happened was that they went off, and I decided I wouldn't go. They weren't going to have my tank. And I stayed there. And eventually, late in the afternoon, because I was there with two dead men, two tanks, and me. And I don't know what made me do it. I really don't know why. I should have gone with the others, but I didn't. And eventually, late in the afternoon, we had a Canadian officer, Captain Law, who had been seconded to the Carbs to learn about jungle warfare, because they thought the Canadian Army might participate later on. They never did, but that's what he was sent there for. And he'd been sent up to find out what happened to me, you see. He came up and he said to me, he said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to take it down in a minute. So he said, okay, he said, I'm going. He said, I'll tell them down in the squadron what's happening. He went off, and a matter of 50 to 100 yards away from me, two Japs took him prisoner. And they didn't kill him, but they were marching him away. The artillery of our people started to shell, and they shelled this area where Captain Law was being marched away by these two Japs, and one landed in front of them, and the Jap that was, because they were both quite frightened, I take it, according to what Captain Law told me, they were both quite frightened, and the one in front scarpered on. And fell, slipped, because it was on a mountain side. He slipped, and Law turned round and smacked this other Jap who had a rifle in his bag, smacked him and dived over the mountain side and hid away in the jungle. Well, I took the tank down afterwards, I got back down. It was quite late in the evening, because I knew full well that once I got on the skyline, the Jap 105 was going to have a pot shot at me. That didn't materialise. They let me go. I brought the tank down, and I was met by the squadron on the road, and they escorted me back to where we was harboured. And that evening, because they fed and watered me, and then because I did nothing since early morning, and what with the tension and the rest of it, I was quite hungry. And Captain Morgan, Major Morgan, came and woke me up and said, "Have you seen Captain Law?" I said, "No, not since he left me this afternoon." "Well, he's missing. Nobody knows where he'd gone. We want you to take us back up this hill." And it was quite a march up there. I tell you, it was bad enough driving up, let alone walking up. Anyway, what happened was I got out of my flea pit, and I went down to the cookhouse hoping to get a cup of tea, because it was in the early hours of the morning. And lo and behold, Captain Law was there. And he'd been brought in by a patrol of the West Kents, who found him hiding in the jungle. And they brought him back. And he immediately said no, he'd had enough, and he was going back to his own army. And that was the last we saw of Captain Law. But he finished up quite a famous man. He went on up through the ranks of the Canadian Army and finished up as Commander of Royal Armoured Corps Canada. And because, as I say, but the following day, it was decided we would have to go up and bury our dead, which we always did. Every unit was responsible for its own dead. So that evening, with the company of the Padre of the West Kents, who was quite an elderly man, was chatting away as we walked up this path to the where this incident had taken place. And I said to him, "Padre, where's the infantry?" "Oh," he said, "they pulled out," he said, "a couple of hours ago." I said, "Jesus Christ, we're going up to bury this dead. There's two tanks up there, two dead men, and we're going to, no infantry there." And there was only about eight of us with this padre. And I think he must have put his faith in the Lord, because he didn't appear to be very frightened. But I was, I tell you, and because it was dark, and we could have been ambushed at any moment. Anyway, what happened was we went up there, and we had a sergeant who had just turned up from somewhere. He's now dead. He was headmaster of one of the famous schools later on in life, Frank Wilson. And when we opened the tank, it was absolutely jammed tight with flies, because the congealed blood and the mess that this man's death had made had attracted all these flies. Absolutely jammed tight was the inside of this tank. And who was going to go in to retrieve the Blake's body? And we all virtually refused. And poor Frank Wilson, he got the job because he was the senior rank. He was the sergeant, so he had to go in. And he got in amongst all these ruddy flies. And we pulled out. All we did was got a blanket and covered the bloke's head up and dragged him out. And we buried them both in one slit trench. It was a slit trench the infantry dug in the defence of the place, and they're now gone. And we buried them both together, Kerr and David Mean Austin. He was 20. And we drove the tank down, and that was that. And I got MID for staying up there and saving my tank.
What in Burma during the fighting did you imagine your prospects would have been if you had been captured?
No, it didn't cross my mind. I didn't think for one moment that anything was going to happen to me, or that I would be captured. No. There was times that I thought that, as a friend of mine once said, we have shaken hands with the devil on many occasions, and I think that sums up the situation. There were many occasions when we did shake hands with the devil. And I suppose he looked and thought, well, let you go.
So you felt, in other words, at the time, invulnerable?
No, not necessarily invulnerable, but I was young. I'm not going to say that I wasn't frightened at times, because I was. But there was, when you look back in history and you think to yourself, you sit inside a tank and there's a chap to the left of you, another one to the right of you, and three behind you. And you're hit 9 times with a 4-7 anti-tank battery. And shells come in. And the chap alongside you is killed. And the one behind you might be killed. But you're not. And I think at the time it was part of, I suppose this sort of chap I was, I suppose. As the way I look at it, looking back into history, that I enlisted, I volunteered, same as my father did before me and my grandfather did before him. I volunteered to fight for king and country. And I took the attitude, it was kill or be killed. And it didn't worry me in the slightest. I must admit that since I've got an elderly man, whether it's because I think to myself I might have to answer for my misdemeanors or what, misdemeanors or not, I don't know. But it certainly worried me more since I've been an older man than it ever did when I was a young man. I had no compassion for the people that we were fighting. And I don't suppose they had any compassion for us. If they saw us, we saw them, we killed them. And that was it. But no, I didn't. There was never any time in those years that I thought that I might be killed. There was many occasions I could have been killed. But I never, ever thought personally that I would be killed. There's 3 times the Japs destroyed the tank in which I was a member of. But even after that, I was hit with a 7.5. We was caught with a battery of 4.7s. And we was hit with a 105. But never did it ever occur to me that it might have killed me.
Is it possible for you to tell me about each of those occasions when the tank was hit? Were you in it?
Well, yes. The first one is already in your records, when the Jap 7.5 hit us and the track was almost broken. There was no one hurt in it, but it could have possibly done us more serious damage than what it did. On the second occasion, we actually caught by 3 Jap 4.7 anti-tank guns. And we went straight into them. And the troop sergeant who was in front, he had his tracks blown off. And his gunner was killed, Geordie Vasey. He was killed. And they were sitting there as sitting target because they couldn't move because they had no tracks. We came up, the troop leader and the troop corporal. The troop corporal realized very quickly that he'd better scarper out of it, which he did, which left me in the troop leader's tank, and we took the full brunt of 3 guns. And 3 guns at 100 yards, anti-tank, penetrated us. We was hit, I think, somewhere about 9 or 12 times. And they put out of action all our guns in a matter of seconds. We had no guns that we could fire apart from a machine gun. And 147 projectile came through the 3.7 teleperiscope, because in actual fact in the American type tank, you look here but you're actually looking there. It's a teleperiscope.
There's about 8 inches difference.
Yeah, there is, yeah. But unfortunately for that, whether he was aiming at the teleperiscope or not, I don't know. But the Jap actually hit the tank exactly where the gunner was looking through. And what happened was the projectile comes straight through and it stopped about 3/4 of an inch from the end. But the force of it hitting the armour and penetrating the armour hit, come from Liverpool, Tommy Butler. It came through and it lifted his scalp right off his head. Didn't kill him. Didn't kill him at all. He lifted the scalp off his head and you could actually see his brains. But it didn't kill him. He was one. The Blonson who came from Coventry was a man older than me. I was 20, 21. I suppose he would have been about 26, 28. And he was a very tall, lean, gaunt sort of a man. He looked as though he'd been to Belsen before he'd actually been there. Very thin. And he was 7.5 loader. And the next thing I knew was the 7.5 that was alongside me had a 4.7 projectile come through the side. And it actually hit the 7.5 that was alongside me. And it hit the actuating shaft. I don't know whether you understand guns at all, but the actuating shaft is the shaft which the breech block works up and down on. You pull the handle and the breech block goes down, and they have an actuating shaft through the gun itself. And the 4.7 projectile comes through the side, hit the actuating shaft out, and I was sitting in a seat which had black Rexine covering. Now if it had been another half inch forward, it would have gone right through me, but it didn't. It hit the back of my seat and took the black Rexine off the seat itself. So in place of an actuating shaft in a 7.5 gun, we had a 7.5 gun with a 4.7 AP projectile stuck in its place. So that gun was useless. Couldn't do anything with it. The 3.7 gunner upstairs, he was mortally wounded in virtually, but not quite, but almost. And his gun, where they'd actually hit the armour on the outside, the gun actually works on a sleeve movement. It works inside, it works up and down. There's the main armour, and the shield inside works up and down. What happened? The projectiles hit the outside armour, and as any engineer would tell you, it virtually pin-punched the two armours together, the inside and the outside. So the gun couldn't be moved up sideways or anything like that. And it hit the traverse mechanism. So we couldn't traverse. We couldn't fire a gun. We didn't have a gun. They were all gone, finished, lock, stock and barrel. And when we did manage to get out, we'd been hit 9 times. And out of 9 times, we'd been penetrated 5 times. So it was an act of God that we got away with it. But the point was that the turret crew, my troop officer, he was there. He was in a panic, quite rightly too. And I thought to myself, what do I do? And I shouted into the microphone, for Christ's sake, get us out of here. And then the only order that we'd received was driver reverse. And fortunately for us, the infantry, the West Yorkshires and the salt of the earth, never run down a Yorkshireman because he's the salt of the earth. They can talk about Gurkhas, they can talk about commandos, they can talk about anything. But if you ever go to war, go with a Yorkshireman. That's my opinion, which a lot of people probably wouldn't agree with. But they were actually fighting hand to hand with Japanese soldiers around us because the Jap soldiers were trying to get at us. And we reversed out back onto the main road, and they come in to look at us and said, right, back to Oyster Box, which was their main base. We returned to Oyster Box, we took out our wounded, where the Geordie Vasey, who come from Newcastle, he was dead, of course, and they were bringing out West Yorkshiremen, the West Yorkshire Battalion, by the drove. They had a big, what do they call it? ADS, Advanced Dressing Station. They were actually bringing these chaps in to be looked at and stuck into ambulances and taken away, and they were coming in quite large numbers. And anyway, we were ordered to get out. So we didn't need second telling. We dumped our wounded, and we turned around and we beat it for Imphal. When we got there, there was the battles for Imphal was at its height. Bishanpur, Nunchigum, you name it, and it was all taking place. And tanks which could not be replaced. The tanks we had to be the ones that were going to see the complete battle. Anyway, what happened was that we had these Rimi people come, and their first opinion was the tank was beyond repair. 25240. That's the number of her. 25240. And had the name on her was Clacton. Clacton, that's right. But all C Squadron tanks all had a name beginning like Coventry, Clacton, Coventry, all those sort of things, you know. And mine was Clacton. Anyway, what happened was they big conflabs going on, and they were bringing in the tanks from other battles. And of course, there were some tanks there that had their engines destroyed, but not their guns. Other tanks had their guns destroyed, but not their engines. So what they did, they cannibalized one to make another. So what they decided, they would take out my useless guns and replace them with guns from another tank that had engine trouble, had the engine blown away. So making one good tank out of two. And that's what happened with tank number 25240. They took the guns out of a tank that had its engine destroyed at Nunchigum or somewhere like that. In fact, some of the tanks they dragged in still had dead inside them. Most of them were all been sniped. But we was there a week. They took my 7.5 out, 3.7 out, and they brought these big Emery wheels, and they smoothed out where the AP shells had hit the armour and made a pin punch. And the holes we had inside the armour, the actual hole, which was about 2.5 inches in diameter, and it was a good job for us that they were AP and not APHE, because if they had been APHE, they would have exploded once they got in amongst us, and they would have killed a lot of us. But that didn't. They were AP. They penetrated. But they didn't explode. They're solid shot. And what happened was that they took the guns out of one, put them into mine, and we lived to fight another day. And and she was destroyed. That old tank was destroyed right down the other side of Mandalay. They blew her up. And what they did with the holes, they actually got acetylene welding sticks, and they filled it up with welding. And then they cut circles of armoured plate and they welded that on. And they were like pimples stuck on the side of the tank. And you could go around. In fact, there was a sign of honour sort of things. So you could go around and count the pimples on the tank and how many times you've been hit and so forth and so on. But that was the closest, I think, that I ever got to it, apart from the incident where I got MID.
And that was obviously April 1944.
That was April 1944.